Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hi, thanks for joining. Please make sure you subscribe to follow us on all the various platforms here on the podcast, as well as on YouTube. The stuff we write on Substack, as well as quick takes on Instagram and on Threads. If you're enjoying what we're putting out there, please make sure you're sharing with all your friends and family. And if you have questions or comments about the stuff we're putting out there, please make sure you leave them in comments to us. We'll be more than happy to cover them in future talks. This has been somewhat of an unusual Olympics. Even without a huge failed drug test in the games, there is an uproar about a group of swimmers competing after being linked with failed drug tests. And we still have countries that have been, for all intents and purposes, banned for systematic doping. However, we have to keep reminding ourselves that in athletics, none of this is new. Athletes are constantly trying to get a small advantage when differences between first and last are not significantly different, if we were to use the parlance in scientific communications. Seeking small advantages has always been the name of the game in sports, whether it's small changes in equipment, whether it's improvements in medical techniques, medical treatments, differences in nutrition, differences in training techniques. Yet none of these seem to be seen as doping, even though they provide the same competitive advantage that doping tends to give. And even though we tend to have uproars about doping scandals every 4 years or so, the act of seeking advantages can go from the gym or the training center with new techniques, new periodization models, looking for small little advantages, small little edges, which includes the pharmacological edges. Pharmacological edges that we might think of as drugs, but at the same time, we'll find them in our local health food stores under the label of dietary supplements. So the question we have to ask ourselves is the act of doping simply part of the sporting competitions and the legacy of the Olympics? Well, let's talk about that.
Warning. The following presentation contains information that might contradict what you have previously heard or believed to be true about how the human body works, and contains material that is not suitable for closed-minded individuals. Enjoy.
To start to answer our question, we first need to look at and discuss what do we normally consider doping to mean. That means we have to have a definition here. When we think about doping, we're generally looking at or think about people taking anabolic steroids, people juicing. Unfortunately, it doesn't provide us a full picture of what doping is. When we start looking at doping as in terms of the history of the concept, it's has its roots in what we think about today as doping back in horse racing in the late 1800s, early 1900s, where trainers would give horses a variety of substances, typically some sort of pain medicine, that was meant to provide the horse with an advantage during the race. Stemming from this practice and based on the work of the biochemists, the physiologists, the physicians of that same time period, we start to see extractions, we start to see isolations of various molecules with purported physiological effects. The isolations of these molecules, these isolations of predominantly hormones, along with some other types of substances, took this concept of doping the racehorses for competitive advantage to doping the athletes for competitive advantage. This also coincided with a ever-evolving athletic kind of environment where, yes, we did have some athletic competitions during that time, but we didn't have it to the same extent that we have it today. This is where we start seeing the professionalism of sports taking to hold. This is also where we start seeing the evolution of athletic medicine. This is also where we start seeing the evolution of athletic training, where we start to take this concept and the concepts of pharmacological advantages and provide those pharmacological advantages to the athlete. This is where we start seeing the concept of dope or doping to go beyond just what was given to the racehorse to given to any type of athlete. Early on, these substances predominantly were substances of purported stimulatory effects, cocaine, strychnine, caffeine, nitroglycerin, or were substances that were known to alter sensations, alcohol, opium. But it also started to incorporate other substances that have noted to or have been noted to provide anabolic effects. From this, we can basically take that concept, that work of the late 1800s, early 1900s, and start to see doping as any substance that can be consumed, ingested, inhaled, or injected that provides some sort of physiological response that culminates in an advantage as being a doping agent. Where we're going to get advantages, we're going to get benefits that would not be able to be obtained without the substance. While we trace our modern understanding of doping to this effort in the late 1800s, early 1900s, starting with the horse racing and then into the early competitions for human athletes, the consumption of substances for competitive advantage or personal benefit is as old as human history. These substances would come from a variety of sources, whether it be plants or animals, or even humans, where there were distinct cannibalistic rituals that were meant to instill certain advantages, certain benefits to the person consuming the human organs. It's very similar to traditions from hunter-gatherer societies where different organs would be eaten from the animal as a way to kind of gather that animal's essence. Very similar ideas. These substances would come in a variety of sources. These substances were first taken from religious reasons. So we would take these substances from all these different types of sources, plants, animals, and even cannibalistic rituals with humans. And it started off as a religious event where we were absorbing some sort of essence of that organism for benefit to us. That soon found its way into the substances being consumed prior to war. And those substances that were taken for war purposes soon found their way into other competitions that were, for the lack of a better analogy, used as stand-in for war competitions, and that would be sports. And it's not something new. This is stuff that we've seen throughout recorded history as relates to sports medicine, throughout historical records as relates to sports in general. Sports were used as stand-ins for war competitions, where we would do some sort of competition as a stand-in for doing warfare in an attempt to prevent mass casualty events between clans, between tribes. While we don't see it in a lot of oral traditions in terms of written logs, we do have noted use of these substances from Egypt, from China, from ancient Greece, from ancient Rome, from Mesopotamia, from the Persians. We even have it in terms of some of the oral traditions within the Americas. We do have it within oral traditions within the Polynesians, where there were substances that were consumed in an effort to provide benefit. It's from the ancient Greece, from the ancient Greeks, and from ancient Greece that we get our earliest records of methods employed by athletes to gain advantages based on the advantageous effects of specific and special diets, where they would consume specific types of foods prior to competition and note having benefits from consuming those foods prior to competition, whether it be special types of fruits or special types of meats. Following these records and the record effects that we see from the way in which animals were treated during husbandry, there were noted effects that took place when male animals were castrated relative to the male animals that were not castrated in terms of vigor, in terms of aggressiveness in terms of stamina. And one of the things that started to take place is that the warriors and the athletes started to see these changes. And what they started to report is that we start getting these kind of stories of ancient warriors and athletes of rapport from these times consuming the testicles that were removed from the male animals and reporting having increased vigor, increased aggressiveness, better stamina, better strength, better endurance. These were the first indicated reports of steroid abuse, if we want to think about it in terms of steroid abuse, and we'll get to the stories about the testicular extractions here in a second. These were the first stories that we had about juicing, about steroid abuse, even though we didn't think about it in terms of steroid abuse, even though we didn't think about it in terms of some sort of illegal or illicit activity. There was nothing done against the athletes that were taking these substances. There was nothing that forbid them from taking these substances. And what we should think about and what should come as no surprise to us is that if you look at all of the excuses that we get from the modern athletes who fail drug tests, it comes back to the foods that I was eating had these substances within it. And that's because it's the substances that we have extracted, that we have refined, that we have synthetically developed from these natural substances that are being used in terms of trying to obtain a pharmacological advantage. And so athletes who test positive for these banned substances, and we'll get into what the banned substances mean and all that as we go through the discussion here, they come up with these excuses that, well, it was found.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
In the food, and I didn't mean to take that substance. And once again, it shouldn't come as a surprise. We should not be surprised that they would use this, since the fact that the root substance that is being banned comes from these food sources. And it's basically a hearkening back to the idea that we consume either the whole product or extracts of an animal or a plant as a means to gain an advantage. And while we have seen doping throughout history, the methods of doping with modern techniques through the use of refined extracts and the manipulation of synthetically developed mimics have led to versions of these naturally occurring performance enhancers that have become far more potent than their natural occurring molecules. The potency that has led to the growing effects of these performance-enhancing substances have led to a parallel growing effort to combat these substances through or by anti-doping agencies. An effort that has been made under the guise of generating a fair or equivalent playing field, equal playing for all. However, if we look at the history of the efforts to curtail doping, that idea about fair and the idea about equivalent playing field is a false flag. It's a false flag based off of flawed logic that we'll get into as we go through the discussion here. It's a flawed argument based off the fact that we're not looking at it in terms of developing a level playing field for the athlete, but for those who are rooting for the athletes. It's a flawed logic. It's a flawed logic because if we had equal access to the substances classified as the dope, as the doping agent, as the performance enhancer, that automatically creates the level playing field. But that's not what we're arguing about. We're arguing about removing those performance enhancers. Some performance enhancers are so ubiquitous to our diet that they had to be eliminated from the list of performance enhancers. It's this same type of argument that comes about in terms of, well, we need to make it fair, we need to make it equivalent, because otherwise everybody's going to be trying to outgun the other person in terms of the development of the quote-unquote best substance. It becomes an arms race. But the problem is that's a flawed argument in itself, because it's not the arms race between the athletes that's coming into play, but it's the arms race in between the pharmacists, the biochemists, the physiologists, the athletes, and not the other athletes, and not the other biochemists, and not the other pharmacists, and not the other physicians, and not the other physiologists, but the anti-doping agencies. There's this arms battle in between. What substances can I take that are not going to flag, not going to cause me to test positive, but still provide a performance enhancement? And what tests can I run? What chemical analysis can I do in order to show the presence of this substance? That's the arms race. It's an argument that misses the idea that not everything is automatically equivalent in the athletic competition. This is where we have to look at the idea about training adaptations, and athletic performance as a excessively complex interaction of various factors that come into play, in which the idea of a pharmacological edge may impact some of those factors, but is not the kind of guiding principle in terms of true competitive advantage. The true competitive advantage that we'll see in between athletes has to deal with genetics, has to deal with genetic regulations, has to deal with phenotypic expression of the traits that we look at for athletes, in which some athletes have an intrinsic inherent advantage over other athletes based off of their genes, based off of the way in which their body responds to distinct training stimuli. Within this, we have to look at where we're actually looking at trying to develop a fair, balanced, and equal playing field. We have to make sure that all athletes have the same access to the same type of training facilities with the same type of training techniques, the same type of training periodizations, the same knowledge base, and the same nutritional support that all athletes are going to have. Not every athlete has that. Not every athlete has the same nutritional support. Not every athlete has the same training facilities. But when we start looking at this idea about performance enhancement, that kind of goes out of the way. The idea of doping in terms of the pharmacological advantage, that doesn't get kind of discussed when we start looking at these differences that can exist within our athletic competitions. We seem to view that as just being part of the price of admission in terms of the idea as it surrounds the differences that can take place with athletes. And so we start looking, okay, what are the differences that might exist as relates to athletes, and what kind of advantage or disadvantage might we get from these performance enhancing substances? We have to go back in time and start looking, okay, what are the performance enhancing substances that are being used, and why might they be used? The biggest performance-enhancing substances that we always think about are steroids, in particular anabolic steroids. And the anabolic steroids, even though we think about it as being an immediate response in which the person takes steroids and all of a sudden, quote-unquote, roid rages, that's not how steroids really work, even though we do see some psychological and cognitive responses to steroid abuse. A lot of the steroid issues, which is why there's a little bit of an uproar about the swimming team and the swimmers who tested positive for an anabolic substance still being able to compete, is that anabolic steroids, even though it does have an acute response, there is a what's referred to as a latent potential effect to anabolic steroids, which means that, yes, I'm going to get benefit from the anabolic steroids while I'm taking the anabolic steroids, but I'm also going to have carryover from the use of anabolic steroids, which means I'm going to have greater growth responses. I'm going to have greater ability to recover relative to those that did not take the anabolic steroids. And that's where we end up having this issue of, well, if you test positive for, or the debate, I should say, where if you test positive for a performance-enhancing substance, you should be banned for life. That's one of the talking points from some of the former athletes. But not every performance-enhancing substance has a long-term effect like anabolic steroids. Not every performance-enhancing substance is going to provide the benefits that we think those performance-enhancing substances provide. If we look at historically what people would be using for performance-enhancing substances, the first performance-enhancing substance that was kind of recorded was by the track athletes in ancient Olympic competitions who would consume figs prior to their competition and get a benefit. And why would they get a benefit? It's not from the fig. It's from the fact that they are providing themselves with a secondary carbohydrate source, a carbohydrate source beyond just the glycogen stores within their muscles. If we were to ban the figs, we would also have to ban all of the sports drinks. We'd have to ban all of the gels, the endurance gels that we see the runners take and the cyclists take. All of those substances, what they're doing is they're simply providing a carbohydrate base so that they can use glycolysis. They can use their anaerobic pathways to provide high rate of return ATP to the muscles to have great amounts of performance. It's not the fig itself. It's the carbohydrates. If you look at the carbohydrate density in the fig relative to what some of the other substances that were being consumed might provide. But at the same time, we have reports about use of plants and plant extracts that would have psychoactive effects that would, such as taking mushrooms that would have a muscarinic effect that would lead to the berserker responses that are told in Norse and in Viking stories about the berserkers that they would use in battle. But it wasn't just the Vikings and it wasn't just the Norse that would use these psychoactive substances in terms of creating a berserker response or an excessively stimulated response, a psychomotor response, a motor response that comes from cognitive stimulant or excessive cognitive stimulant that leads to a greater motor response in the individual. Once again, we see a lot of these things in terms of war response, but at the same time, we would see them utilize very similar substances in the stand-ins for war, in the sporting competitions. If we move forward into more modern historical time periods, looking at the late 1800s into the early 1900s, when we start looking at this idea about doping, the first kind of dope that we would see used in athletics were stimulants. In particular, caffeine and coffee stimulants or ephedra alkaloid extract stimulants that would be used by individuals that would not consume coffee or caffeine. And these were stimulants that were naturally occurring, that were extracts from natural occurrence, that were used to combat fatigue, particularly given the avenue for most athletic competitions were endurance-style competitions at that point in time. The stimulants that we think about today in terms of stimulant, the coffee, is actually no longer an actual banned substance. Coffee and caffeine was banned from international competitions due to the stimulatory effect that caffeine has and the impact that caffeine at specific doses can have towards performance in terms of increased power output, increased endurance, increased strength, increased power that can come about from caffeine ingestion.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
However, what we have found out through research is that because there's so much caffeine in what we consume, the dosage that has to be given in order to get a performance benefit is so super physiological that it actually doesn't create a benefit if the person is habituated to caffeine. If the person is a normally caffeinated individual, someone that normally consumes caffeine. However, there are other stimulants that are out there that got synthesized in the early 1900s that became more in the forefront, both in terms of medical treatment, but also in terms of drugs, if we think about in terms of drug use. Starting in and around the 1930s, 1920s, 1930s, the benzoids, in particular the ephedra-based benzoids and the ephedra-based benzoid alkaloids, most notably the amphetamines, and the impact that amphetamine has on as a stimulatory effect in terms of performance, offsetting of fatigue, increasing of muscle contraction and muscle contractility, increase of strength and stamina, increase of force development in the individual. We start seeing more use of these types of drugs in the 1930s, 1940s, both in terms of athletes taking them as well as in military applications. The other thing that we started seeing in the turn of the 20th century, the 1900s, going into the 1910s, 1920s, movement away from consuming of the organ in organotherapy, that is using the organ of an animal for therapeutic or for medicinal benefit, or in the case of doping for actual performance benefit, and starting to use the extracts that come from those organs, where we're using extracts from the organ or synthesizing extracts from the organ, as opposed to consuming the organ itself. And so one of the things that we saw in ancient time was a lot of consuming of organs in order to extract the hormonal signals, the metabolic signals, the metabolite signals that can come from the organ as a means to, quote unquote, extract the essence from that animal. This is the time in history where we start seeing Banting and the pancreas insulin experiments, where extracting insulin from the pancreas in order to help with diabetic conditions, leading to the creation of the insulin therapy from insulin as opposed to the pancreas itself. But that's not necessarily going to look at it in terms of doping or performance benefits. This is where we have to go back and start looking at the ancient texts that we have, the ancient medical records that we have. We saw recorded in medical catalogs from ancient Greece, ancient Mesopotamia, Persia, ancient Rome, was the utilization of extracted testicles in order to increase vigor, increase stamina, increase strength, increase performance for males, male warriors, male athletes. And one of the things that we start seeing during this shift towards utilizing the extracts is that the injection of extracted secretions from testicles would create the same exact response that we would see from the person's eating the testicles. And this led to refinement and eventually the synthesis of the steroids, the anabolic steroids, testosterone as principal anabolic steroid coming away from the testicles, that led to various biochemical reactions and biochemical synthesis that led to a whole host of testosterone-derived steroids, testosterone-derived or anabolic steroids that have become kind of like the hallmark for what we think about when we think about doping. But all of this came about from the work in the 1900s and 1910s, 1920s, 1930s that led to the rise in the use of the anabolic steroids and the use of the anabolic steroids, where we start seeing the use of anabolic steroids as early as the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s, where the practice came and went. It became more of a hallmark of certain types of athletic endeavors, certain types of athletic competitions, in particular those competitions that involved a lot of aesthetics, way in which the body looks, where we start seeing kind of the anabolic steroids and the use of testosterone as kind of like a hallmark for bodybuilding and power athletes and weightlifting. But then it kind of went out away from the bodybuilders and the weightlifters into other avenues of athletic performance. First, noted reference for use of such anabolic steroids within at Olympic competitions was in the 1950s, 1960s with what is usually referred to as the Eastern Bloc countries, and a lot of their power athletes, their sprinters, their weightlifters in particular weightlifters, utilizing the anabolic steroids. But we also started seeing other types of anabolic hormones coming into play at this point in time, which includes the human growth hormone extracts that used to come from pituitaries that, once again, with refinement of technique, started to be not as harmful in terms of the extract and in terms of the use of the supplement, excuse me, the use of the dope, the growth hormone, because we could get it out of out of recombinant techniques, out of lab techniques, as opposed to having to extract a pituitary and give the person growth hormone, where we started seeing combinations of different types of anabolic hormones being used in conjunction with each other, not just taking the anabolic steroids, but taking anabolic steroids with growth hormone in order to promote tissue growth and strength gains, once again, in a lot of the power athletes. It's also during this time going into the mid-50s, into the 60s, we started seeing other types of hormonal responses and hormonal doping coming into play. One of the principal dopes that came into play running into the 1960s, 1970s, into the 1980s is the emergence of erythropoietin EPO, particularly in endurance sports. This is where we start seeing a lot of blood doping coming into play, particularly in cycling and in long distance running, in ultra endurance activities, where the EPO is a hormone that's going to promote the production of red blood cells, the oxygen carrying blood cells, that in conjunction with training mechanisms that will promote increase of aerobic capacity, increases stamina, increases aerobic performance, increases time trial performance for the individual. And so one of the things that we start seeing in terms of this idea about doping, in terms of what we can and what we can't take, the use of hormones versus the use of other metabolites, is we start seeing a growth of an industry that comes out of this idea about providing a pharmacological benefit that gives a benefit, an advantage to the individual that they would not get from just doing nutrition, just doing training. And this is where we start getting the supplement industry kind of burgeoning out of this doping industry. Because what we're doing is we're basically taking something that has become illegal and illicit, the non-medically advised hormone replacement therapy, which is basically what the anabolic steroids and the growth hormone happen to be, and the EPO. All we're doing is simply just doing hormone replacement therapy, but doing it without having medical supervision. And from that, we get a host of chemical substances that within the metabolism of the body can act very similar to these substances that are hormonal in nature. And this is where we start getting the dietary supplement industry coming into play. And this is where we start looking, okay, what's the actual legacy that we happen to have from all of the doping, all of the what can I pharmacologically get in terms of benefit beyond what I can get from just my nutrition and just my training from athletes, where we have exploded a gym culture, a fitness center culture, a culture of thinness, a culture of body image towards the low body fat, high muscle mass. And this culture has accepted the doping as part of what it takes in order to get, in order to achieve that body image, that ideal of what I should look like, without also accepting the amount of work that is necessary in order to achieve that. And part of this goes into changes in nutritional habits, changes in exercise habits, but a lot of us will also go ahead and take the pills, as we've discussed before. Yes, there's a pill for everything nowadays. And there are a lot of people who want to utilize certain types of pills that contain metabolites that mimic exercise. And that's where we start having to worry about a lot of these supplements that we might be taking that could actually or are actually derivatives of the doping agents that come about from the athletic endeavors. And so that's why we can look at what's the actual legacy of these Olympians. What's the actual legacy of the ideals about competition and the ideals about needing to win. And one of the biggest legacies is out there is doping. Doping is the legacy that no one really wants to talk about. And it's not because of trying to, or let me say this, it's not because the individual wants to be the best, even though a lot of times, yes, the individual wants to be the best, but a lot of it has to deal with the external pressures, the external coercions that go into the competitions, where instead of competing for yourself in order to better yourself, you're competing against everybody else, but not just competing against everybody else, competing against everybody else for the accolades of those who feel like anybody can do what the top, what the best athletes are able to do. And it's something that most people don't realize, the actual physical capacities, the actual physiological capacities, the actual anatomical and physiological changes that these athletes have had to make to their body in order to compete at what they do. The amount of time, the days, the weeks, the months, the years of training, the sacrifices that are made in order to compete at the level that they compete at. And it's not this idiotic idea that took hold because Malcolm Gladwell said it, that you have these 20,000 hours of training and time you have to put in order to master stuff. That's not what we're looking at. In fact, that whole idea about the 10,000, 20,000 hours is been debunked over and over and over again, even though Malcolm Gladwell still holds it to be true. And people who are advocates and acolytes of Malcolm Gladwell keep citing it and citing him, even though there's only one study out there that actually looks at that idea about time and time commitment in terms of mastery of a skill and proficiency of the skill. And it was in one small population, and the difference between individuals was minimal at best, but yet it still gets cited over and over and over again. That's a story for another day and a talk for and something we'll talk more in depth on a different discussion. But in order to maximize your athletic potential, in order to maximize in competition, it's a combination of several factors that come into play that most of us don't actually have in us to do. Either because we don't have the desire, the drive, the internal self-want, self-motivated, self-monitoring in order to drive ourselves to be that best in that one avenue. But we watch them and we watch people do it and they make it look so easy that we think, oh, anybody can do it, without realizing how difficult those things happen to be. And because the athletes hear that, oh, anybody can do that, they think that they have to do it even more. They have to do even further. They have to go even farther. You have to go more. And part of it also gets into this, the ideal that gets out there. It's the ideal that we have to be bigger. We have to be stronger. We have to be faster. And every athlete in each generation is getting bigger, stronger, and faster than the generation before. And there's a point at which we reach maximum capacity. This is where we have to, even the Olympic motto of faster, higher, stronger, Citius, Altius, Fortius, where we're always trying to get faster, we're always trying to jump higher, we're always trying to be stronger than the athletes that came before us. Yes, it's a good goal. Yes, it's something novel to shoot for. But at the same time, we have to look at it and say, okay, what is the actual capacity limit that we happen to have for our performance? And when we start looking at some of what these Olympians and what some of the idols and role models that we look to in order to establish what I want to be and what I want to gain, the desire to utilize these substances, these supplements, these external aids that I would not be able to get to the point that I want to get to without taking them leads into why we start seeing doping at the levels that we see doping, even though we may not hear about positive tests, as one of my professors in grad school would constantly harp about when talking about track athletes. You assume everybody is on some sort of substance. But just because we have to make that assumption doesn't mean everybody is. But the other thing that to remember is that not all substances act the same. And it goes back to the comment that one of the former Olympians made about the fact that if you fail one test at one point in time, you should be banned for life. Not all of the doping substances have that long-term potentiation, that long-term effect. A lot of the substances that are on that banned list tend to have very short effect time, do not have a long lifespan in terms of overall effect, which means that if I fail a test today, I should not be banned for life if it's not one of those long-lasting substances. If I get banned for an anabolic substance, however, if I get banned for taking testosterone or utilizing a testosterone derivative, such as the swimmers that are linked to issues where they claim it's tainted meat, where that can't be, and I'll get that in a second. If I'm taking an anabolic substance, if I'm taking a testosterone or a testosterone derivative, because of the long-term impact that testosterone has on my response to training, on my recovery intervals, I will constantly have a benefit. I will constantly have a performance enhancement from that substance, even if I'm no longer taking that substance, simply because of the impact that it has long-term in terms of potentiation. Now, if we get back to that idea about the naturally occurring substances and consuming things that are found in some of the foods that we might eat, there is an idea that, if the animal is being given hormones, I'm going to also be consuming those hormones. That's not how the hormones work. If it's an organ that is normally producing hormones, yes, I can extract hormones from eating that organ, from eating that meat. But what we're actually looking at with these claims about tainted meat or the idea that if I consume milk from a cow that's been given growth hormone, I'm also going to be consuming that hormone. That's not how it's going to work. The half-life of the hormones in circulation in terms of clearance, in terms of utilization, is very short. Yes, some of the fat-soluble hormones, some of the steroid hormones, if they get injected into a fat deposit, can remain in that fat deposit. And if I consume that fat deposit, yes, I can potentially consume that steroid. But that's not how it usually is given to animals in terms of hormone supplements. The hormone supplements are there in order to help with growth of the animal. Yes, they're given in super physiological doses, but we're not going to be consuming that animal in such close proximity to the dosage that we would actually be consuming the hormone itself, unless it happens to be a hormone that's stored in the tissues, such as in a fat-soluble tissue and a steroid. If I give an animal a hormone in order to encourage growth, it's the same thing that happens in my body if I take that same hormone in order to encourage growth. I'm going to have long-term potentiation, which means I'm going to have changes in the way in which the genes are being regulated on the cells that allow for growth. And for skeletal muscle, we're looking at activation of what we call satellite cells. Those are the stem cells that will allow for the skeletal muscle to grow, because skeletal muscles don't replicate. They utilize additional nucleuses from different cells, those are the satellite cells, in order for the muscle to be able to grow. When I use an anabolic steroid, what I'm going to do is I'm going to change the way in which the fibroblasts are going to adapt in order to create connective tissue. I'm going to change the way in which I activate satellite cells in order to cause those satellite cells to grow and to replicate and become dormant again, which is going to increase the potentiation for me to have larger muscles and thus be able to produce greater amounts of strength. Just because the animal has been given a steroid does not mean that steroid is going to be found in the tissues that are being consumed. That's why I said that's not how hormones work, which means that we cannot make a claim, regardless of how we want to make the claim, that if I eat substances from an animal that's been given a hormone, I'm going to be getting that hormone myself. The only way to do that is to consume all of the animal's fluid, all of the animal's tissues, in a very close proximity to the dosing of that hormone. That's the only way that can work. which is what we have to kind of think about when people make these claims about the fact that, oh, I'm testing positive for a banned substance because of the foods that I'm eating being given this banned substance. It doesn't hold water. It's not truthful in terms of that kind of claim. The other thing kind of goes hand in hand with this idea about the time frame is, what does cooking do to all of those hormones in terms of actually changing the nature of the hormone? How does the digestion of the substance, do we actually get the hormone into the body if we actually ingest it? A lot of times we start looking at hormones that are taken orally, taken by mouth, eaten or consumed. They're coated in some fashion so that they can survive the passage through the digestive system in order to be absorbed. That's not the case when we start looking at it in terms of meats or in terms of vegetables, in terms of fruits. Yes, we can consume materials that have a endocrine disrupting capability because they act or look like the actual hormone in the body. But that's something that's completely different than what the idea here in terms of the doping happens to be. Endocrine disruption has a different effect on the body. And that endocrine disruption has a different effect on the body will not necessarily provide a performance enhancement. It could actually cause a performance detriment. It could actually lead to a loss of performance, a lessening of performance. Well, thanks for listening. Hopefully you got a bit out of the discussion as it relates to the history of doping and the legacy that sports and competition has on stuff that we take in order to improve our performance, not necessarily just as an athlete, but in health and in general use as relates to kind of like aesthetics or what we look like in terms of body image. We'll come back and we'll address some of this, the psychology of what's going on. And we have a long discussion coming out hopefully soon as relates to the bad ideals that Malcolm Gladwell has pushed as relates to the amount of time that is necessary in order to master a skill, and the fact that only one study actually supports his idea, and he basically forms his opinion off of a logical fallacy in terms of that notion. But thanks for listening. Hopefully you got a bit out of this. Stay tuned for future discussions. Please make sure you're following us on all the various platforms here on the podcast, as well as on YouTube, the written stuff in Substack, as well as quick takes on Instagram and on Threads. If you have any comments, questions, please make sure you reach out. We're more than happy to discuss them in further detail or in more details than we offer here on the podcast or on YouTube or on the written stuff.